And welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, we're bringing you the best on the natural nurse and Dr. Z. And we love to connect with you either on ground, that means in person in the new vocabulary, or online. And for that, we have so many lectures, workshops, online and on ground events coming up in September. In fact, it's a really busy month. So if you go to naturalnurse.com and look on calendar, you will find them all listed. For instance, on September 12th, we have a free herb walk, and that will be, you know, fall herbs, American Herbalist Guild, Long Island Chapter Meeting, free and open to all. Late summer herb walk, we actually go outside and gather edible and medicinal plants. And then on September 13th, we have a really big class, which is extremely well attended and also filling up, but it is called Career Paths in Natural Medicine. So in this class, we will guide you on how to pursue a career in natural health. Are you interested in massage therapy, health coaching, acupuncture, dietetics, natural foods, herbal medicine, of course, homeopathics, energy medicine, like using a pendulum, etc., and what to do with that in terms of your career. So that is something that you can look into and take. Also, there are 3 CE credits. That means professional credits for anyone taking that class and many of the other classes. We also have in September our Chinatown Herb Walk, where we actually meet in Chinatown for the day and learn about Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. We have a sacred tea ceremony. We go to a Chinatown museum. And then we also have, believe it or not, all this going on in September, our edible and medicinal medicine making workshop. And that is in Connecticut at Gilberti's Organic Herb Farm. And that's a full day of going out in the field, gathering and identifying edible and medicinal herbs, but also making them into medicine. We only do that workshop twice a year, and that's the last one for this year. The next one, if you like that, is in January and in Florida at Hippocrates Health Institute. So you might want to catch us in the October one in Connecticut if you're up in this area. So tons of stuff to interact with us, and we're so happy to meet you in person. Today we have as our guest Danielle Coppolino. And Danielle is a registered dietitian with a master's degree in public health nutrition. And also she got that from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Danielle completed her undergraduate studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, so she's an MIT graduate, with a degree in brain and cognitive science. She's also a certified dietitian nutritionist for the state of New York, so she is certainly well-trained in all kinds of aspects of health and wellness. Danielle runs a private practice in Manhattan, and she provides nutritional counseling services with a specialty in digestive health. She works with people individually and through online programs as well. In her WTF, which is called What the FODMAP program, and we're going to find out about FODMAP, perhaps you've heard of that. She is also an author of several books, including Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach, which was named one of the top 7 wellness books of 2017 by People Magazine. And she also wrote the Microbiome Diet Plan. So we're going to talk to Danielle today about healthy gut, flat stomach, FODMAP diet, and all things related. So thank you so much for joining us today, Danielle.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
How are you? The long weekend.
Yes, well, as you know, I am about 9 months pregnant, so I'm happy
I
made it through the weekend.
Well, I know that, but our weekend, so that's really exciting that you're joining us at that time of your life.
Yes, I'm excited to be here talking about flat stomachs when I have a Very round one.
Well, I'll tell you what. You can look forward to regaining your flat stomach. I certainly did, really, literally, immediately after having my first child. And I don't know if you're doing anything for stretch marks, but one thing that works excellently well is actually popping open vitamin E capsules and putting them directly on your stomach while you're pregnant.
That's a great idea. Thank
yeah,
you.
It really helps because I do not have one single stretch mark. And really, the body is pretty elastic, so you'll be amazed if you've maintained your healthy eating, which knowing you, you have.
For the
That's
most
going
part,
right
I've,
back.
I've tried.
Well, best of luck with your up-and-coming blessed event. That's really exciting.
Thank you.
And so let's talk about your book and your work. What made you become a nutritionist in the first place?
I know it sounds like a kind of an interesting departure from brain and cognitive science to dietetics, but I actually like to think I'm, you know, in the vanguard here, because now what we're seeing is that there's such a deep connection between the way that the brain works and the way that our gut works. So I've always been really just fascinated by science and learning and research and up-and-coming research and finding new things, new trends that people don't really know about yet, and finding ways to communicate that. So once I learned about probiotics and the gut microbiome, I was pretty much hooked and wanted to learn everything that I possibly could. And very early on in my studies, I was fortunate to be in a microbiology class where I learned about gut bacteria, and you know, I haven't really looked back since then.
Yeah, there certainly is a complete connection which might not have been recognized before in those two aspects of your study, which is the brain and the gut. And yeah, I'm actually just finishing a book on Alzheimer's and its relationship to the gut. And those bacteria are so amazing because they seem to have chemical messengers that actually can influence human behavior.
Yeah, it's amazing. It feels like every day there's a new sort of mind-blowing study that's come out. So I'm really fortunate to be working in this space. And, you know, one of the first days, I think, of my graduate studies, I sort of worked my way into interning with a doctor, Jerry Mullen, who has been a pioneer, I think, in this field of gastroenterology and nutrition. And I was really fortunate to be able to sit in on many of his patients during that time and learned a tremendous amount. And I think it was probably the first day that I was there that I saw how frequently he was, you know, quote, prescribing the low FODMAP diet to his patients. So I knew that was something that I had to really learn more about.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And it is always excellent to honor our teachers and our lineage. And in fact, Dr. Mullen has been a guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z as well, and he and I have been co-presenters at many conferences. So you are right. He's really out there with the message and very evidence-based, as your work is as well. So that's excellent.
Yeah.
So why don't we just go into, you know,
mentor.
Defining this word that we've thrown out a few times. Everybody does maybe know how to spell it, so I'll spell it.
Yeah.
That's FODMAP, FODMAP diet. What is a FODMAP?
I'll spell out what it stands for once, but it's kind of not that important to memorize what it stands for. It's more important to understand what they are. So FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which is a total mouthful. But they're all carbohydrates that have something in common. And even though they don't look alike or smell alike or taste alike, really, what they have in common is that they can be difficult to digest, particularly for people who have irritable bowel syndrome. And as a result, can cause a whole slew of digestive symptoms that we do not enjoy having and that are all too common. So I'll give you some examples of the foods that are part of this.
Well, tell me a little bit more about the commonness. So how many people are suffering with this? And maybe many are even undiagnosed. They're just taking sort of antacids 10 times a day.
It depends what study you're looking at, but I've seen numbers range from 1 in 10 people to 1 in 4 people that suffer from digestive disorders or digestive discomfort. So it's very, very prevalent. Even if it's 1 in 10, it's a very big number.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's something that's really major if we're talking about, you know, population. Mm-hmm. That's a huge amount of people that may be experiencing these symptoms. And, you know, yet they have never even heard of this, which is, I would say, a completely safe and natural therapy to consider before you decide to go on strong medications.
Yes, I completely agree. There's really no harm in trying something like this. The only thing you're sacrificing is a little bit of effort. So I think it's definitely worth it.
Express it in your book, too. Like if somebody were to decide to try a FODMAP diet, first of all, they have to research it. They want to know if they have to speak to their doctor first. I would say you do not need to speak to your doctor first because there's really no dangerous effect of trying it. And your physician may not be familiar with it, but maybe you want to get him a copy of Danielle's beautiful book called Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach, which goes into FODMAPs. And, you know, FODMAPs can be foods. There's sort of a list of foods that are FODMAPs, right? Would you say that's how you start out by finding that out?
Yes. So most of the research currently that's being done on the diet, you know, to go back to honoring our mentors and honoring the people that we work with, most of the work is actually done in Australia in terms of testing the foods and finding out the FODMAP content of them. I think as it's becoming more widespread, it's going to, they're going to expand to the United States as well. But doctors and dietitians at Monash University in Australia have been really pioneers in testing the foods. So through them, people like myself are able to create lists of high and low FODMAP foods to be able to share with patients and clients what's suitable on an elimination diet, and an ongoing.
Well, let's also run down what kind of symptoms someone might present with to you as a nutritional consultant in your practice that might make you decide, wow, this person is a good candidate for trying the FODMAP.
I would say the symptoms are gas and bloating, constipation and diarrhea. The one, which is sort of funny now, almost hallmark sign to me that this diet might work for you is people will often call me and say, I look pregnant. I look 6 months pregnant, and I'm not. And that, to me, is a sign that there is likely, especially if they've tried other things, that there's fermentation happening inside the gut that's causing this gas and this bloating and discomfort.
So that's pretty common, and that means not if it happens once. Let's say it happens once after you go to a wedding and you know you're overeat.
That doesn't count.
And you'll often hear, sometimes I've heard them say, you know, even if I drink water, I mean, anything that I eat seems to make me feel bloated. And that would certainly be a good signal, because what do they do about that in conventional therapy? If they went to, let's say, a typical gastroenterologist, what would a list of symptoms like that initialize in terms of a treatment protocol?
Right. I mean, it depends on the type of doctor, and sometimes it's not even a gastroenterologist. Sometimes you really might want to consult a gynecologist, because you can have gynecological issues that manifest as bloating as well. But they probably will either go with the, you know, simple over-the-counter type of like GasX, Miralax route, because often doctors will say that bloating is really a sign of constipation. Or sometimes they start running tests, and, you know, these tests can take up a lot of money and a lot of time. Sometimes they're necessary, but often they're not.
What's amazing to me, and this is something I hope is changing, but I actually still see, is that they do not even ask you what you're eating.
Yes, I hear that all the time. Doctors frequently do not ask what you're eating, and even I've had people, you know, bring my book or bring a handout about FODMAP foods to their doctor, and I think often, not always, but often a doctor is very dismissive of it, and I think it's because they just don't know about it, and they don't want to bother to learn about it so that they don't have to answer questions, because honestly, it can become very time-consuming for a doctor or any health practitioner to answer questions and stay
even
on top of this.
The FODMAP diet is a specialty, and you know we're going to talk about which foods are on there, et cetera, but I'm talking about the concept of that specifically a gastroenterologist or a regular, you know, family physician kind of doctor does not seem to even recognize that food has to do with digestive disturbances. And that, to me, is like mind-blowing, because it seems like you don't have to go to medical school for 8 or 10 years to understand there's a connection between what you put in your mouth and how your stomach feels.
I am 100% on board with you. I agree. It is one of the greatest frustrations that I have.
But luckily, you know, you are, you know, for instance, this book too, Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach, you know, of course, the microbiome title is a little more scientific. I'm just talking about walking into a physician's office and handing him this book. He may think it's just about weight loss when really it's so much deeper. And you have such great recipes in here, which really make the program easy. And you have in the back numerous studies that actually show, you know, the fact that this is evidence-based. So, you know, those are good in your references. But nonetheless, it's so obvious when you go to the mainstream medical literature that what you're talking about is completely proven to be helpful, as well as the fact that if we look at any intervention as a healthcare provider, I always like to assess the risk and possible benefit ratio of a particular procedure.
Yeah, and this has, as you said before, very, very low risk. I mean, really, no risk.
To give it a try.
Yep.
So let's talk about some of the, you know, I think very surprising foods that are on the FODMAP elimination list. Because sometimes there's stuff that, you know, sort of, let's say, everybody knows are super healthy.
Right, so some foods that you probably wouldn't think of that are on this list are foods like apples, pears, mango, asparagus, mushrooms. Then there's some foods that you may think of, like wheat and milk and beans, and artificial sweeteners are a big one as well. But there's really, it's a very nuanced list, and FODMAPs are found in every category of food. And within every category of food, there are foods that are high FODMAP, and there are foods that are low FODMAP. So, for example, it's not all dairy products that are, you know, quote, out when you're on an elimination diet. It's only dairy products that have high lactose.
Okay, and what would some of those be?
So, for example, high lactose dairy foods would be milk and regular yogurt and ice cream, and low FODMAP dairy products would be, for example, butter has almost no lactose in it, and hard cheeses as well.
Well, as a nutritionist, let's talk about butter for a minute,
okay.
And then we're going to take a short break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, because, you know, butter has been maligned as a terrible food. It's really interesting. I'm sure you know about a study that came out very recently called the PURE study,
yes.
P-U-R-E, that actually looked at the fact that animal fats and even high saturated fat foods seem to be protective against heart disease, the exact opposite of what's been promoted in mainstream thought for decades now. So butter is one of those, because butter really tends to be an excellent food for most people, even though it's dairy. And probably because of its chemical composition, which actually aids in the growth of the exact kind of microorganisms that you stated in the beginning might be actually helpful, a really healthy microbiome.
Yes, exactly. I know. It's hard to convince people sometimes of things that they've been told their whole lives are bad or actually can be good for you.
And you find that most people who are, let's say, FODMAP sensitive really are okay with butter, which is a saturated fat and is a dairy product.
Yes.
Now, of course, that wouldn't be accessible in terms of their choice to a vegan. So what would you tell a vegan?
Well, that you could enjoy other healthy fats, such as, you know, All fats basically are low FODMAP, so any type of oil, coconut oil or olive oil, would also be perfectly fine.
So that's good, because that helps with the feeling of being satiated.
Yes.
So, and you talk about that also, and in your, when you look at your recipe ideas in the back of the book, which are just beautiful pictures, by the way.
Thank you.
You know, they're things that you can clearly see would be really, really filling and satisfying. They're not like what you think of as just a salad.
Yes, exactly. I want people to feel like there are things that you can enjoy, even if you're on something that's called an elimination diet.
So I'm interested, because of beans, that you have a hummus recipe in your book, and it looks like a delicious one as well.
So the diet is very, very, very specific at times. So what the researchers have found, where they've tested FODMAP content of certain beans, is that chickpeas actually are low FODMAP when you have smaller portions of them. So if you're having, for example, less than a quarter of a cup, and canned beans have lower FODMAP than freshly cooked beans, so that makes it even easier for us. So if you have a small portion of homemade hummus, you actually should be fine. The problem is most all store-bought hummus has onions and garlic in it. Oh, which I just realized I forgot to mention, probably the two most common FODMAP foods that you wouldn't necessarily think of are onions and garlic.
And that's so big.
That
is
really
big. But I have a little comment on that as well, and
sure.
Then we're going to go take our break, is that, you know what's interesting? When you study Ayurvedic medicine, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've delved into that yet.
Yes, yes.
Onions and garlic are actually considered something that increases hot energy, let's say, in a way that
mm-hmm.
our listeners understand. And they actually often say either eliminate or limit onions and garlic. And yet on the other side of the spectrum, they are promoted so heavily because of antibiotic effects and other healthy aspects that are in those two plants. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I actually noted, and I mentioned in the book briefly too, that, you know, when traveling in India, I saw there's certain holidays that, you know, are very widespread. People don't eat onions and garlic, and there are restaurants, particularly of the people of the Jain religion, that do not eat onions and garlic at all. So it is definitely possible to find Indian food that is suitable for this diet.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're going to just take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Danielle Coppolino. You can find her at her website and blog and Facebook. It makes it easy, just DanielleCoppolino.com. We'll have our show here archived at naturalnurse.com and also at prn.fm, so you can listen again and get links to Danielle Coppolino. And we're talking about her book, Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach, and also about what is the FODMAP diet, and perhaps you want to try that for yourself, fast, easy, and safe. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we are talking today with Danielle Coppolino, registered dietitian with a master's degree in public health nutrition from Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and also from MIT with a degree in brain and cognitive science. And she is the author of Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach, as well as the Microbiome Diet Plan. So thank you so much again for joining us today, Danielle.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And so we're getting into the FODMAP diet. So continue, please, with a discussion of a list of some of the yes foods and the no foods on a FODMAP diet.
Okay, let's start with some of the yes foods so that we don't scare people and make you think that there's nothing that you can eat, because that is very, very untrue. There are so many things that you can enjoy on this diet. So, for example, there are fruits and vegetables. You can have oranges. You can have strawberries, blueberries. You can have carrots and peppers, and really every single category of foods has a low FODMAP, or as you said, yes food. So you can enjoy rice and quinoa, butter, as we were just talking about earlier. Even regular sugar is, you know, somewhat of a controversial food, but in moderation, that also is okay. As a yes food.
Tell us, that's amazing. So if they use a little bit of sugar in some of these recipes, beautiful recipes that you have, that does not seem to stimulate the FODMAP diet. But if
yes.
The person is also suffering from a yeast overgrowth, such as Candida albicans,
yeah.
Growth, which is tied into a lot of these dysbiotic symptoms, the bloating and all that stuff.
That's
so
true.
Then it might not be a good idea. So for each individual, I imagine there's a different specific protocol, but they could give it a try.
Yes,
I'm
exactly.
Very interested in the fact that you're discussing the fact that if you wanted a sweetener, sugar might be less of an agitator on the FODMAP diet than would be artificial sweeteners.
Yes, I mean, I happen to dislike artificial sweeteners for many reasons, but in particular, the class of artificial sweeteners that we call sugar alcohols. So, you can recognize those as basically if a food says that it's sugar-free and it has an ingredient that ends in the letters OL, as in sorbitol, maltitol, xylitol, erythritol, those types of sweeteners are especially problematic when it comes to bloating and digestive health.
Yeah, and I think they are awful.
Yeah,
awful.
I agree.
I also wrote a whole article on artificial sweeteners, and it's really odd because you'll see people eating this, you know, let's say a fried food, junk food meal, stuffing themselves with it, and then using diet soda, like it's going to make them lose weight.
Right, yeah, that tends to not work. Also, anyone who's ever gone to a candy store and, you know, loaded up a bag of sugar-free candies thinking that they're guilt-free probably knows that they're paying the price in the bathroom after the fact. So
yes.
They can really, even if you're not regularly experiencing digestive symptoms, too much artificial sugar can really set anyone over the edge.
Right, and I really prefer, you know, just none.
Yeah.
And a really interesting way to pick up on that, you know, it won't always say, oh, contains artificial sweeteners on the front of the package. It might
yeah.
be called light.
Yes, exactly.
So very often something that has whatever, yogurt light or this light or that light, if you turn it around to the back, put your eyeglasses and a magnifying glass on, you will see that we'll have exactly what Danielle just shared with us, which is the name of something that ends in O-L. You may have no idea what it is. Maybe xylitol or any number of sucralose.
Yep.
Now, sometimes they disguise it by changing the name. They've even changed the name of different sweeteners to something that you think is natural, like it'll be called natural sweetener. That's all it has to
yeah,
be called.
Yeah, that's true. That's
and
true.
That's,
I know. Sometimes you have to really get really desperate. Sometimes you have to call the company and ask them what they're putting in their food.
Now, besides the artificial sweeteners that are a sugar alcohol, as you indicate and you do have in your book, what about things like sucralose or even high fructose corn syrup, which does not end in an OL, and now is no longer called high fructose corn syrup, since so many people recognize that as something that they perhaps shouldn't have and shouldn't give to their kids, the industry changed it to just fructose. They took off the high fructose corn syrup name.
You know, now that you say that, I was wondering why I keep seeing fructose on food labels. So, okay, so each of the examples that you just asked about, so sucralose and fructose, they're different. So sucralose is not a sugar alcohol. It's not a sugar. It's actually, you know, if you're in a laboratory and you're looking at it, it's actually not a problem when it comes to the FODMAP diet. I don't recommend it anyway because I don't care for artificial sweeteners because I think they make you feel like you're eating something sweet but not providing any calories, and then your body starts wondering where the calories are.
Yeah, it also does not turn off that satiety effect.
Exactly.
Like sugar would make you go, okay, I ate.
Exactly.
Actually can lead to weight gain instead of weight loss.
100%, yes, completely. Fructose, on the other hand, is definitely a high FODMAP food. So when I was earlier explaining what FODMAP stands for, and M in FODMAP, monosaccharide, that's, you know, a scientific term for a sugar that is made of one sugar. And fructose is the example of an ingredient that is a monosaccharide of fructose. So actually the whole list of foods that are problematic are foods that are high in fructose. So yes, when you take pure fructose, it can be very problematic if you're sensitive to that category of foods. Whether that's called high fructose corn syrup or regular fructose, or whether it's called agave or honey, to name some other sugars, those are also very problematic if you're sensitive.
Oh, they are, even though those are more like whole foods, like agave nectar, which is taken out of the big bulb on the agave plant.
Yeah. So I know it has. It's funny. It could be completely natural or completely artificial, but even agave, which is natural, is almost all fructose, which if you are sensitive to fructose, which is one of the categories of FODMAPs, can be a problem for you, as well as honey. Maple syrup, on the other hand, is a good alternative if you are sensitive to fructose, but you are okay having some sugar. That's a good option.
Oh, that's great to know. Because that's metabolized in a pathway that does not, and it also does not usually lead to aggressive yeast growth. So that's definitely a good alternative. And learning to eat less sweet. You know, when we look at healthy, let's say, ethnic diets from around the world, they very often have a much wider palette of flavors, which actually are reflected in your beautiful recipes and seem to be very deficient in the SAD, or standard American diet.
Yes. Yes, you're right. When you eat ethnic foods, you really find that desserts are not the highlight of the meal.
And right,
spices,
and even just
spices,
everything having to be sweet, because you bring in all kinds of lovely spices like black pepper and things like that that really can help, you know, with the flavoring aspect.
Yeah, I think flavoring and spices are really key to making you feel like, somewhat with satiety like you were talking about, it just makes you feel like you're enjoying real food, which you are, and not depriving yourself, even though there are a few things that you're leaving off.
Right, and like you have a lovely basil pesto recipe that includes pine nuts and cheese, right?
Yeah.
Olive oil and fresh basil and chives, and very simple to make and certainly would be, you know, very satisfying.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, if the reason that I have that in there is to show you that most recipes for pesto include garlic in it, but it doesn't mean that you need garlic to make a pesto that's delicious.
Now, what do you think the issue is with such common and certainly very healthy fruits like apples and pears?
Well, apples actually have a number of different FODMAPs in them. I know it's like counter to what people think because we've all been told an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And yet so many times when people ask me what I do and I start explaining this diet and I mention apples, it's almost like a light bulb goes off and you can see them say, oh, every time I eat an apple, my stomach hurts. Or every time I eat an apple, I get bloated. So they are... They have a lot of fiber, and it's not that they're very good for you. It's not that apples are bad for you. It's just that they're very highly fermentable and poorly digested in the gut. So the bacteria, even if it's good gut bacteria in our intestines, will sort of chow down on this undigested apple and produce their own gases, which make us feel bloated.
Yeah, it's a complicated topic,
yeah.
That's for sure. But it's a good thing to, try it yourself and see what works. That's a really good idea. I love the symptom worksheet that you have on page 173, where people are going to kind of look at the frequency of indigestion, gas, burping, bloating, abdominal distension, et cetera. And then it looks like you break down in this simple plan that you have different eliminations on different weeks so someone doesn't go to like zero choices the first day. That's very
right.
Interesting. And then they can track their own incidence or frequency of these different symptoms so they may be able to track down on their own which of the FODMAPs are the worst for them personally.
Yes, exactly. So two things. One is I wrote this book so that I would guide people through an elimination diet. So at first, you're taking out all of the high FODMAP foods, but certainly not all foods. And then I guide you through reintroducing one category at a time so that you can identify which category or categories are bothering you so that you end up really eating the most varied diet that you possibly can. I also do provide, as I think you're saying, an option so that if that's just too much for you to take out all these different foods at once, even though it is very manageable for many people, I do provide what I call an alternate plan when it's too much to bear, where you take out one category at a time rather than all of them.
Well, that's a good way to go. So let's take our little and last break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're going to hear about more shows that are provided for you by Progressive Radio Network, a huge network. We have about 250 downloaders on our show here, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. 250,000. And of course, this Gary Knoll shows are here and many excellent and exciting shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. So when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with registered dietitian, nutritionist Danielle Coppolino. We're talking about her book, Healthy Gut, Flat Stomach. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
You're listening to PRN. The Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Vegetarian Vision and New Life Health and Wellness Expo, happening this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, September 9th and 10th, at the Hotel Pennsylvania on 7th Avenue and 33rd Street, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. For only $15, you will experience over 50 speakers and exhibitors, including Gary Knoll, Dr. Esselstein, and Dr. Joel Furman. Experience food, fun, meditation, yoga classes, pageants, fashion shows, and cooking demos every hour. Get your tickets now at www.vegetarianvision.org. That is www.vegetarianvision.org.
interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
And welcome back once again to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I am your host, yours truly, Ellen Kam. I'm a natural nurse. You can find us at naturalnurse.com. If you go there and go along the top, there's all kinds of other things to investigate, such as our many books that we have available and workshops. They're all under calendar. Classes, CE credits, even for registered dietitians, such as our guest Danielle Capolino, for nurses, acupuncturists, massage therapists. And if you're someone who does not have a license, the classes are all open to you as well, and you can get a certificate rather than continuing education credits, which professionals with licenses require. So we're so happy to have you as our guest today, Danielle. And you're telling us about the FODMAP diet, so we will continue with that. Let's talk about gluten, since that, I know, is a term most of our listeners are totally familiar with.
Thank you for having me. Yes, so gluten is a term that people are familiar with hearing, but I think a lot of people still don't really understand what it is, because people will read my book and then tell me, oh, I feel so much better, I'm gluten-free. Well, there's actually a difference between being on a low FODMAP diet and being on a gluten-free diet. The thing is that gluten is a protein, and FODMAPs are all carbohydrates. The thing that they have in common is that they're all both found in the same foods. So they're both found in wheat, in barley, and in rye. So many foods that are gluten-free are low FODMAP and vice versa, but there are definitely exceptions to that rule. So I believe that because being on a low FODMAP diet offers more flexibility than being on a very strict gluten-free diet, that it offers some advantages if you don't need to avoid gluten. But also, I think a lot of people will go on a gluten-free diet and feel better, and perhaps much of the reason they're feeling better is actually because they're eliminating FODMAPs, not necessarily because they're eliminating gluten.
Well, that's a hard distinction. Because I know people who do choose to try a gluten-free diet. And so since they're not going to be eating bread, and by the way, I'm not a big fan of the things they say gluten-free bread, because they have all kinds of strange starches and tapioca and potato flour and all kinds of, you know, sweeteners very often. But they'll use something like rice cakes or even, interesting, let's say, Okmok crackers, which are rye-based, and they do feel better. But you're saying there's a cross-sensitivity to rye as well.
Yeah, so gluten is in rye as well. So probably if someone is feeling good with those crackers, and I know and like those crackers very much, they're probably having more of a sensitivity specific to wheat rather than to gluten.
A wheat sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And these terms are really important because, because you're a health professional. What is a person who is celiac? Because that term's linked in there often.
So if you have celiac disease is an autoimmune condition where your intestinal cells actually respond to gluten, the protein that is in wheat, barley, and rye, and it flattens out the cells in the lining of your intestines so that it really damages the integrity of your intestines and damages your ability to absorb nutrients and also causes a whole variety of symptoms.
So that's actually much more severe because then we're talking about, you know, a genetic issue. But those terms lately are, you know, they can be anything from celiac. You could be gluten sensitive, in which case you're going to really react to a wide array of grains. Or you could just be wheat sensitive, which just cutting out all the wheat, which is pretty big right there, because I would say in the typical American diet, people are eating wheat and gluten, you know, 3 to 4 times a day for every meal.
At least, yes. Yes.
I'll throw
in there, you could also be FODMAP sensitive. So that would mean that you're sensitive to all of those grains, wheat, barley, and rye, but you can enjoy certain things like soy sauce, which has gluten in it, but in a very small quantity, or even light breading on something. So in many cases, you know, if you have celiac disease, you have to be very, very vigilant and avoid all sources of gluten completely.
Be motivated to do it because they could get it anywhere up to like an anaphylactic kind of reaction. So they
People get very sick if they have celiac and they ingest gluten. So you have to be very, very careful, and that's really a different situation. Yes.
And they're usually very motivated because they get an immediate reaction, a very quick, it's not a 72-hour IgG-mediated reaction. They know. And they'll be the label readers, and they'll ask the waiting staff in a restaurant. And then how do you eat out in a restaurant on a FODMAP diet?
Well, that does take some vigilance as well. That's probably the biggest complaint that the people I work with as patients have is eating out. Although it's gotten easier because gluten-free has become so popular and so restaurants have just become more comfortable with knowing how to avoid certain ingredients, there are plenty of things that you can enjoy in a restaurant, but as you're starting out, it can be intimidating. So often you'll want to ask for sauce on the side because sauces are where things get tricky. You don't know all of the ingredients. Same thing with dressings. But because FODMAPs are all carbohydrates, protein and fat are totally fine. So, for example, you could have fish or chicken or steak and oil. And there are carbohydrates you can enjoy as well. So you could have, you know, a baked potato, sautéed spinach with no garlic, and a fillet of fish. I mean, that's a perfectly balanced, healthy meal that you could have in a restaurant. Or you could have eggs. Eggs are protein. You could have scrambled eggs.
But you probably wouldn't want to have toast.
Exactly. No toast. You could have potatoes, though.
So what would be a good choice to have with the scrambled eggs?
You could, again, like this morning I made scrambled eggs with, I had frozen vegetables in the freezer, and so I had red peppers and spinach with scrambled eggs. So that would work. You could have roasted potatoes with your eggs. You could have some fruit. You could have lactose-free yogurt.
How is rice?
You could have rice or even some oatmeal.
Okay, and oatmeal, although it might have gluten, is considered FODMAP-free.
Yes, and you can also, if you have celiac disease or if you're very sensitive to gluten, you can have, you can buy gluten-free oats, which are technically, oats themselves really don't have gluten. It's just an unfortunate circumstance of our food system that they're grown. Oats and wheat are grown, often in very close proximity, and they're processed and shipped and stored in very close proximity. So there's a huge amount of cross-contamination. So if you get gluten-free oats, you're not going to notice that there's really any difference. It's just the way that they're sort of grown and handled and managed.
Okay, so that's interesting. You know, why don't you tell people, we only have a few more minutes here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with our show with Danielle Coppolino. Tell us what happens if someone does become your client. Like, how does that happen? And what goes on?
So I work with people in a few different ways. So I work with people one-on-one. So I will often meet with people over Skype. So I can work with people all over the country or the world, and I'll send them an intake form with a questionnaire looking at the symptoms that they currently experience, just like you were mentioning that is in the book. I like for people to tell me exactly how they're feeling before, because often people start feeling very good very quickly and forget that they felt like crap before. So we like to have some reminder of what they felt like. And I work with people over a series of about 6 weeks, typically, and kind of guide them through an appropriate dietary plan. And then I also offer online programs. So I have a program that you had mentioned in the very beginning. It's called WTF, What the FODMAP. And in that, it's more of a group program, so it's a go-at-your-own-pace. And I have video modules and handouts that guide you through each step of this diet. So you can, you know, kind of digest it all at once or take your time. And I go over lots of questions like, you know, what do I do if I'm a vegetarian? How do I eat out? And there's handouts and worksheets and videos and a Facebook group that go along with that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. What is the best place for people to find you, Danielle?
My website is probably the best way, and it'll guide you to all of my other social media as well. And it's just www.daniellecapolino.com. It's C-A-P-A-L-I-N-O.
And I want to really wish you the best and everything wonderful in your new up-and-coming adventure on
Beyond
Parenthood. And let me tell you, that's going to, you know, be really a wonderful and life-changing experience for a young first-time mother with so much knowledge. Chances are your child will want to eat every single FODMAP food that comes. So I wish you the best of health and happiness to you and your family. And thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Till next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.